Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I apologize for the delay, and thank you all very much for coming. More source sheets are on their way, and hopefully within a minute or two, we should have the projector sorted out as well. Can I just have a quick show of hands if you've got a source sheet? Okay. All right, so hopefully that's enough so that people can share for now, and the others should arrive soon. It should be on the app as well, and hopefully it will be up here in a moment, and more will arrive shortly. So thank you all very much for coming. And obviously this is not the easiest of topics. I chose to do this topic for a couple of reasons. The first one was actually an extremely general one. A couple of years ago at Limud, I gave a talk on Rav Ovadia Yosef a couple of months after he had passed away. And Rav Ovadia Yosef, as some of you may know, is really one of the greatest halachists of the last century. And a friend of mine said to me afterwards that he had been to 15, 20 Limuds or so, and he'd never actually heard anything really focused on halachic literature. Which seemed to him rather strange, given into a halachic topics and discussions at Limud. But in terms of something that focused on halachic material proper, what's called in Hebrew she'elot v'tshuvot, the responsa literature, which really for over 1,000 years has been one of the most fruitful, wide-ranging types of literature that Jews, that rabbis have written, really from the period of the Gaonim in Babylon in the 9th, 10th century, all the way until today. So at that time I thought, next time I'm at Limud, I want to do something on a serious halachic topic. The reason that I chose this topic per se is that I think it comprises a fascinating case study of a very difficult personal topic, in which we are able to, despite sort of laws seeming inherent limitations for being sensitive, law, halakha, will normally say something is prohibited, something is permitted, something is commanded, something is forbidden, etc. Within those terms, there often isn't that much space for significant amounts of sensitivity. I have to thank my dear friend Jack, who this is now the second time he's brought a handout. Hands up if you don't have one, please, and Jack will distribute to you. If you're online, you'll see my website at the bottom of the page. The source sheet is up there as well. Once again, apologies for that. Legal systems in general, and one might also assume halakha, might not be seen as having a lot of room for human sensitivity. And yet what I hope I'm going to show is that not only is there room in halakha for sensitivity on such a tender topic, but more than that, it's a fascinating case study of an area of halakha which has undergone tremendous development, really has turned 180 degrees from the very earliest sources that we find. I think there is an actual specific moment in history. It occurs in the year 1805 in Pressburg, where I think the topic just changes 180 degrees, and that's part of the story that we're going to tell. And I also have a few thoughts, really not scientific thoughts and not ones that I could claim with any measure of certainty are correct. I've got some thoughts as to what might be behind this very dramatic change that takes place, linking it to wider European history. With that, let me begin. I've put two very difficult sources at the beginning. In fact, maybe I'll even start by a preemptory apology. Obviously, this is an extremely sensitive topic. I'm going to do my best to deal with it sensitively. I can also imagine that there may well be people in the room who have more than an academic interest in the topic. So I apologize if at any point in the process of talking about it, it seems as if I'm just sort of trying to get through the material. I'm going to try to avoid that, but apologies in advance if it does happen. Final, by way of introduction, the first time I encountered this topic was, unfortunately, not working my way through the Shulchan Aruch, but actually in practice. Somebody who I was not particularly close to as a friend, but who lived very close to me and who I interacted with on a daily basis in his early 20s, from one moment appearing to everybody who knew him as happy, involved, focused on lots of different aspects. One night in Israel, with the having served in the army with greater availability of firearms, one night whilst on guard duty, took his own life, and it had a terrible effect on everybody around him. For weeks, we all felt under this dark cloud. Just sources number one and two on the source sheet, not these two at the beginning, describes the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. Echad mibnei chabura shemet, if one of the group dies, tidag kol ha-chabura kula, all of the group become concerned, it affects everybody. Rashi says, yidagu, they become concerned, yiru min hamita, which is to say they themselves confront questions of mortality, their regular lives are interrupted by being brought up close with such a distressing situation. And I think I can really say that anybody who's ever been in proximity to a suicide, to a case like this, it affects them for the rest of their life. Obviously, they'll hopefully return to a normal routine, but it's something that will always stay with them. Let's begin with sort of a classic statement of the rabbinic halachic view of suicide. Suicide, death in general, is really a way into, I think, any culture. The way in which every culture treats death reveals a huge amount about that culture. Just from a very cursory thought of what our knowledge of world systems, world cultures are with regards to suicide, one can compare a Japanese kamikaze idea to maybe a modern Western idea of autonomy. Our tradition has a very different take on it. This is a work called Gesher HaChaim, The Bridge of Life, one of the most important works on Avelut, on mourning. We read as follows: one who is ma'abed et atzmo ledat. That's going to be a phrase that we're going to come back to many, many times. This is the halachic phrase for suicide. Ma'abed atzmo ledat literally translates as wittingly, consciously destroys himself. Is considered a murderer like any other murderer. Rotseach. There is no difference whether he kills himself or someone else. And in certain ways it is more serious than regular murder, the murder of somebody else. For through his actions he denies God's ownership over his life and soul, and rejects God's part in his creation, and the recognition that our life is but lent to us by God. The basic understanding that informs the whole topic is that we are not the sole masters and authors of our life, but rather our lives are a gift to us by God. And therefore, just as there is a general commandment to look after ourselves and to preserve our health, all the more so there is a commandment to make sure that our life lives its natural course and we do not put an end to it. There's a very distressing story, the second source on the sheet, not a Jewish source, a report from London in 1860, which shows just sort of how far such an idea could go to such distressing and seemingly absurd conclusions. This is not a Jewish source, this is a source about Christian England in 1860, where not only was suicide truly considered to be murder, but a person who attempted to kill themselves and failed would then be put to death for attempted murder. A man was hanged who had cut his throat, but who had been brought back to life. They hanged him for suicide. The doctor had warned them that it was impossible to hang him as the throat would burst open and he would breathe through the aperture. They did not listen to his advice and hanged their man. The wound in the neck immediately opened and the man came back to life again, although he was hanged. It took time to convoke the aldermen to decide the question of what was to be done. At length the aldermen assembled and bound up the neck below the wound until he died. Oh, my Mary, what a crazy society and what a stupid civilization. It's written by a man called Nicholas Ogarev, who was a Russian emigre in London, writing to his mistress. both of them somewhat outsiders to Victorian England. Maybe through being outsiders were able to see how crazy things had got. Now let's begin the topic fully. Although I started with this very classic, harsh rabbinic statement against suicide, viewing suicide as murder, interestingly, before the rabbinic period proper, we find Jewish sources which have a very different take on suicide, most famously in Josephus. Josephus, the great historian, many people differ as to how to evaluate Josephus. Was he a traitor? Was he a patriot? That's not our topic for now. Famously, Josephus describes the mass suicide at Masada by the Jews who were besieged by the Romans, who decided to collectively kill one another rather than face the Romans, face defeat at the hand of the Romans. I won't read through the whole source. Scholars also discuss if this is actually Josephus' opinion or whether he's just reporting that which Eliezer, the leader at Masada, had said. I won't read all of it, but you can see the excerpt from the speech, just the bit I've made bold towards the bottom of the first page. For the laws of our country and of God himself have from ancient times, and as soon as ever we could use our reason, continually taught us and our forefathers, and our forefathers have corroborated the same doctrine by their actions and by the bravery of their mind, that it is life that is a calamity to men and not death. This is part of this exhortation by Eliezer to convince those in front of him that it is indeed a positive action that they will be taking. Josephus then describes the great, really, enthusiasm with which they all act in taking their lives. And finally, Josephus, seemingly now in his own words, finishes off that when the next morning the Romans came to see what had happened, came within the palace, this is over halfway down the second page, and so met with the multitude of the slain, but could take no pleasure in the fact, though it were done to their enemies. Nor could they do other than wonder at the courage of their resolution and the immovable contempt of death, which so great a number of them had shown when they went through with such an action as that was. Now, maybe one also shouldn't expand from this to say that Jews at the time, or at least Josephus, had a positive view of suicide as a whole. Obviously, every single case of suicide is a completely unique one, and certainly they divide into multiple subcategories. Here we're talking about self taking one's own life rather than losing one's life, or going into slavery to an enemy rather than a person in the regular course of their life who can no longer bear to be alive. Obviously, they are not the same thing as one another. Nevertheless, such a description as we find in Josephus would be very, very foreign from later rabbinic sources. I'm only going to take questions throughout. If they're just clarificatory questions, then we'll open up at the end, if that's all right. Is it?
I was just going to say that Josephus also argues elsewhere passionately against suicide, and in the third place passionately for it.
Quite, and that's the scholar's dispute. Absolutely. Thank you. There was an excellent Melvin Bragg in our time on Josephus, which if you want Josephus in 35 minutes, I recommend, which also speaks about that. Let's go to the rabbinic sources. This is source number 4, the bottom of page 2, Masechet Smachot. For those who might not be familiar with it, the rabbis always had a bit of a dark sense of humour and liked to call things by their opposite. So the tractate that deals with death and bereavement is actually called Masechet Smachot, the tractate of Simchas, of rejoicing. This is not part of Shas, of the Babylonian Talmud. It's what's called Masechtot Ktanot, often translated into English as minor tractates. They have an interesting history. The material is very old, from the Talmudic period. The editing seems to be at a later period, probably during the period of the Gaonim, sometime between the year 700 and the year 900. But here we have a very different take on suicide, and you'll notice immediately we're talking in legal terms, not talking about how we judge the individual, we're talking about how we respond. And we're really going to be talking about two separate points. We're going to be talking about the definition of suicide, and you'll pick up throughout that the word suicide in English is far too catch-all for what we're speaking about. And then we're going to talk about the law, how we, those who are left alive, then respond in the case of a suicide. So let's begin. Ha'amabed et atzmo b'dat, one who commits suicide literally, consciously, willingly, wittingly destroys himself. Ein mitaskin imo b'chol davar, we don't engage with him at all, meaning the normal apparatus of hilchot avelut, the laws of bereavement, do not apply to such a person. Rabbi Yishmael Omer, Korin Alav, Havei Nishlacha, Havei Nishlah. It's not exactly clear what Rabbi Yishmael means literally, but it's some form of curse that we say to such a person to have a go at them for having taken their life. A worthless person. Fascinatingly, Rabbi Akiva responds, Hanach lo bestamor, leave this person alone. Al tibrachehu, al tiklalehu, neither bless him nor curse him. After we leave that discussion, we carry on back to the laws. In such a case, those who have been left behind, the relatives, the friends of the suicide, ein korin, ein choltsin, ein maspidim alav. They neither tear their clothes, they do not take off their shoes, and they do not give eulogies for such a person. All of these are elements that normally comprise the mourning or the bereavement process. These are not done. Aval omdin alav b'shura. Nevertheless, once the person has been buried, those who attend the funeral stand in rows. Some of you may have seen this if you've been at a funeral after a person is buried. Those who attend the funeral stand in two lines, and the mourners pass between them. And as they pass between them, people say, "We wish you a long life," or other similar words of comfort. V'omrin alav birkat avelim, and similarly, we give the blessing to the mourners. We say, Baruch Dayan Emet, blessed is the judge of truth. Why? Mipnei shehu kavod lachayim, because this is out of honor to those who are alive. So we see something very interesting, which is that the number of the laws that normally kick in the wake of a death, a number of them do not apply. We don't do kriya, we don't tear our clothes, we don't take our shoes, we don't give eulogies. However, we do a number of them that seem to be to do with comforting the bereaved. Then, the piece that I've put in bold, we give the principle behind all this, klalo shel davar. The sum of the matter is as follows, kol shehu lichvod hachayim, all that is for the honour of those who are still left alive, the family, the relatives, the friends. Harabim mitaskim bo, the congregation, the masses, they do in fact involve themselves with. Because she'eino lichvod hachayim, but everything which isn't for the honour of those who are alive, meaning everything which is for the honour of the dead, kavod hamet, the honour of the deceased, such as the eulogy, such as tearing their clothes, ein harabim mitaskim bo, the masses do not involve themselves with. Very, very interesting distinction. It seems that the laws of bereavement essentially divide into two categories. On the one hand, those which are for the honour of the deceased, and on the other hand, those which are for the honour of those who are bereaved. In the case of a suicide, in a case of ma'abed et atzmo ladat, a person who has committed suicide has given up the right to receive those various honours that would normally be done. However, the honours which would be normally given to the family are nevertheless given to them. Something which isn't mentioned, but which was the case for many, many hundreds of years, is that suicides would not be buried in the major cemetery. There'd be a portion of the cemetery to the side for suicides. It is worth pointing out, I've tried to do a little bit of research over the last few months about the history of suicide in general. It's worth pointing out that actually in Christian Europe, the honour of the family of the suicide was in fact truly besmirched. They were also punished and sanctioned for what their family member had done. They would lose any potential inheritance, they would lose honorific titles, etc. It seems that the halacha never expanded its negative view beyond the individual. It never applied it to the wider family. The next halacha brings us now to the definition of suicide, definition of ma'abed et atzmo ledat. Ezehu ma'abed et atzmo ledat. Who is such a person? So now we're going to have to read carefully. Lo she'ala l'rosh ha'ilan v'nafal v'met. It's not talking about somebody who was on some high place, a tree, a roof, and fell and died. V'lo l'rosh ha'gag v'nafal v'met, nor a roof. Ela ze she'amar, rather a person who says explicitly, Hareini ole l'rosh ha'ilan, I'm going up to the top of this tree, o l'rosh ha'gag, v'apil et atzmi, and I will throw myself off, v'amut, and I will die. Somebody who gives stated verbal intent. V'ra'uhu, and we witness this source. It's witness sha'ala l'rosh ha'ilan v'nafal v'meit, o l'rosh ha'gag v'nafal v'meit, that he goes up to a high place after having said this and falls and dies. Such a person, harei ze b'chizkat ha'ma'abed et atzmo, but that he falls into the category of ma'abed et atzmo, but that of willingly, consciously having taken his life. We repeat the same principle as before. Anybody who takes their life, we do not engage with them. We do not apply the normal apparatus of mourning to them. We then have another halacha, which seemingly we could have worked out ourselves. Halacha gimel. Matzahu chanuk v'talui be'ilan. If a person is found hung on a tree, harogu mushlach al gabei hasayaf, or if they have taken, or if they are impaled on a sword or a knife, such a person, chari hu bechezkat ma'abed atzmo shelo ledat. Such a person, we'll come back to this, but this is quite nuanced language. Such a person falls into the category of having taken their life shelo ledat, unwittingly. So they are assumed to have taken their life, but not to have taken their life consciously, therefore they are not what we would call a case of halachic suicide. They are not ma'abed, that's not badat. Badat means with conscious, with willingly. Why? Because we don't have any proof, we don't have any verbal testimony, maybe no written testimony that says this is what they intended to do. B'chol ha-ma'abed atzmo shelo ledat, and any such case of a person taking their life unwittingly, ein monin haimenu kol davar, we hold nothing back from them whatsoever. So at this stage, it seems to be the case that the definition is as follows. We require two separate pieces of evidence. On the one hand, evidence, testimony that the individual plans to take their own life. And on the other hand, we need to actually have circumstances which corroborate that. In the absence of either of those, we would not apply these very strict sanctions that go to ma'abed atzmo ledat, somebody who willingly takes their own life. So, strong checks and balances, but very clearly the category exists, and when it exists, when we do have such testimony that a person plans to take their own life, and they appear to indeed have done so, we apply these laws. The next two sources, source number 5 and 6, maybe I won't read them themselves, but they are actually very important. In the Middle Ages, a dispute occurs between two of the greatest of the Rishonim, of the medieval commentators, the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, about the scope of the category of Kavod L'Chayim and Kavod L'Metim. You'll recall that we said a few minutes ago that the principle is that everything which is for the honour of the bereaved, of those who are still alive, we apply just like in any normal case of bereavement. However, anything which is for the honour of the individual who has taken their own life, we withhold from them. Kavod lemetim, we do not give. Honour to the dead, we do not give. Kavod lechayim, honour to the living, we do give. Rambam and Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, disputed as to where the dividing line was between the honour of the dead and the honour of the living. There are certain things which obviously fall into the category of honouring the dead, certain things which obviously fall in the category of honouring the living. The piece that I quoted had given us a number of them. Maimonides expands the category of kavod lemeitim, of honour to the dead, to also include what we call regular avelut, which is shiva and shloshim, the 7 days that the family sit, stay in their home, on low chairs, where everybody comes to greet them and comes to comfort them, says Maimonides, what is the Shiva for? The Shiva is for the honour of the dead, and therefore in a case of ma'abedat moladat, in a case of suicide, one would not sit Shiva for them, nor would one observe Shloshim. The Ramban, Nachmanides, actually understands that the role of Shiva, the role of Shloshim, is to give comfort to the bereaved. It's not about the deceased per se, it's about the bereaved. And therefore, even in a case of suicide, we would nevertheless still sit Shiva, still say Shloshim. Although the Rambam and the Ramban do not mention this, because it seems to not necessarily have been the practice at their time, the same would seemingly apply to Kaddish as well, as to whether or not Kaddish is for the honour of the dead or for the honour of the living. And according to Maimonides, therefore, not only would one not sit Shiva or observe Shloshim, 7 or 30 days, also the mourners would not say Kaddish for relatives of theirs who had committed suicide. The Shulchan Aruch, source number 7, Rav Yosef Karo, which is the authoritative legal code in the 16th century, quotes word for word Maimonides, who takes almost word for word the pieces that we have read. He gives a definition of a suicide just as the prior pieces that we read do. We need to have evidence that the person intended to take their life. We also need to have seen that they have taken their life or have circumstances which seem to definitely prove that. And to such a person, we do not apply anything which is for the honour of the dead, including Shiva and Shloshim. So the Shulchan Aruch decides, like Maimonides, like the Rambam, who reads from the Gemara these strong sanctions which are applied in the case of a suicide. And so what we have done so far is to have gone from the beginning of the rabbinic period until the 16th century, where, as far as I can tell, with the exception of that important dispute between Maimonides and Nachmanides, there isn't particular development, there isn't much that happens. I just put this summary at this stage. The definition of a suicide is both stated intent and carried through. That is ma'abed atzmo v'dat, done willingly, done wittingly. With regards to after the fact, mourning for a suicide, only that which is for kavod ha'chayim, for the mourners, and not that which is kavod ha'metim, for the deceased. That is applied, therefore, no tearing of garments, no eulogies, etc. Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch also decide that this includes no Shiva or Shloshim, we don't spend the 7 days mourning for them, and various additional practices are also applied. We don't bury a suicide in the cemetery. Kaddish is not said for them as well. Yes?
Did you say that? That the Kaddish isn't actually mentioned, that this is your
Kaddish? The history of Kaddish, this is not just now about suicide, is an absolutely fascinating one. Although the text of Kaddish is a very ancient text, it appears that Kaddish being said for the deceased is actually only a practice which begins probably around the 11th century in Ashkenaz, so around Rashi and Tosfot. The Rambam and the Ramban, both living in Spain, may well not have been familiar with it at the time. It's very interesting that something so sort of iconic to Jewish mourning is actually such a late development. At this stage, we reach the really the critical turning point in our story. And this is a man called the Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, is without a doubt one of the most important rabbinic figures and halachic writers of the early modern period. Unfortunately, I'd even go so far as to say tragically, he is almost always stereotyped as a figure whose sole contribution is a war against modernity, who is seen as the original ideological figure behind what becomes the ultra-Orthodox Haredi world, rejection of modernity. There is this one phrase of his which people love to say, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, anything which is new, any new innovation is prohibited by the Bible, an absolute no to everything. nothing could be further from the truth. If you spend your time going through She'elot v'Tshuvot Chatam Sofer, his multi-volume, fantastic responsa work, page after page is filled with new insights, with very daring readings. What is true is that when it came to denominational relations, relations with the beginnings of the Reform movement, he didn't indeed take a very harsh line. But in so many other areas, which were not, as it were, politicized areas, he was an extremely daring figure, as we're going to see. Adina?
I'm still not completely clear on what is the legal definition of stated intent.
It has been left, you're right, somewhat ambiguous, and that's something that we will clarify with the Chatam Sofer. That is part of the flex that he's going to find himself. So the Chatam Sofer, born in the 1770s, is asked a question about a certain case, a definition of a suicide. This is written in the year Taf Kufhei, which corresponds to 1805. And you will see as we go through it how just he knocks down as he goes point after point after point, which would make the case, the possibility of a case of a suicide, to be an applicable case. He starts off by, actually, I won't read it through precisely, he starts off by questioning the language of the text with which we had started. You'll recall in source number 4, there was this, top of the third page, don't need to go back to it, so I'll just mention it, there was this funny statement of a person who was found having seemingly hung themselves or impaled on their sword, but without any stated intent beforehand, is seen as being in the category of ma'abed, that's more shalolodat, of taking their own life, but doing so unwittingly. Chatam Sofer questions such a strange phrase. He says, wouldn't it be much simpler, simply just to say this person is not considered ma'abed atzmo ladad, not considered to have wittingly taken their lives. That would be a much simpler way of phrasing it. It seems to be that the writer creates an independent category of somebody who takes their own life, but really corresponding to Adina's question, does not do so willingly. And therefore he comes up with the following case. In any situation no matter seemingly how absolutely clear, which does not have that stated intent. Meaning, even if we find a person hung inside a room in which they themselves have locked the door from the inside, in which it would be impossible to ascribe it to seemingly any other source whatsoever, in any case such as that, where we do not have the stated intent, we do not consider this a case of ma'abed et atzmo bedat. And you can see towards the bottom of the... well, let's read that second paragraph, that second full paragraph on page 4. Al kein nired li, it appears to me, the habraita nishnit bedikduk, that the Talmudic piece was written very specifically, lo zuaf zu mairi baba kamaita. We're not just talking about Misha Anu Ro'in or Lin Be'ilan, somebody who goes up to the top of a tree, Blishum Siba, for no reason whatsoever, Shiavihu La'alot L'Sham. No, we just don't know why he went up there. That's not what the writer, what the Gemara is talking about. Ki En Lo Sham Shum Malacha, he hasn't got any business going there, V'lo Shum Tzoref, no need. Umiyad Nafal V'meitan, he immediately falls off and dies. We're not talking about that case. That such a case is obviously not to be considered a case of suicide. Even though we might have thought, Asher lichora hochiach sofo al tchilat aliyato, that the end proves the original intention, shelashem kach ala, that for that purpose he went up, kadei lahapil atzmo, to throw himself off, afilu hachi, even in such a case, ein monin mimen shum davar, we wouldn't hold anything back from a person. De'efshar she'ein anu yodim mitmunotav, perhaps we do not know what is concealed in him, Mahaya Rotseba Aliyato, what he wanted when he went up, the bit that I've made bold. Umi Yodea Machshavot B'nei Adam. Who can know the thoughts of man? In this case, how on earth can we be confident in applying to such a person their intent. V'lo amrinan hochiach sofo al tchilato. And we do not say that the end proves the beginning. So, in the absence of any of absolute proof that this was the person's intent, we say, mi yodea machshavot b'nei adam, who can know the thoughts of man? This is his first stance. He now continues and adds an additional one. V'lo zu bilvad, and not only this, el afilu amar behedya, even if he says explicitly, hareini oleh, I'm towards the bottom of the fourth page, I'm going up to this roof, to this tree, almanat lahapil atzmi, in order to throw myself off. V'gam ra'inhu oleh, and we also see him going up. Ach lo ra'inhu nofel v'me, but we don't actually see him falling and dying, ma'otoh ha'aliyah, from that place, al-hagag. Af al-gav sh'achar zman matzanuhu nafal, even though after a while he is then found. So in this case, we have the original stated intent, we have the conclusion, we just lack the middle part of actually having seen the act. In such a case, even when he's found in exactly the same place as he said he was going to throw himself, ba'oto makom mamash, the bit that I've now made bold, mikol makom, nevertheless, kevan shelo ra'inhu nofel v'meit, since we do not see him falling, ma'oto ha'aliyah, from that place, batzma, she'amar, that he said, she'aleh la'afil atzmo, lo daininan lo ka'amabed atzmo l'adat, we do not understand him, we do not see him as having taken his life with him. If we have that absence of following his progression, however long it is, any moment where the camera is not on him, that is no longer to be considered ma'abed atzmo l'adat. Who knows what happened in that situation? Right, so the I'll take your question. I'll jump forward with it. We'll carry on working our way through the Chatam Sofer and looking at the different stringencies or the different checks that he puts on it. In the wake of what often happens in halachic topics is somebody at a certain stage will come up with a strong, a novel approach, and that person is of significant stature, and after that piece has been written, it will then become known as such and such's opinion. It can be relied on in certain circumstances. After the authorship of this piece, it doesn't become known as the Chatam Sofer's opinion. Everybody piles in after him. Every single later writer just adds in more and more pieces. So as you correctly point out, later writers essentially develop this idea that there are many cases where there is going to be some sort of time lag where the person is not able to be seen. So, as you say, suicide notes cannot be considered to be stated intent because there is going to be a significant gap, presumably in the time, or at least there might be one between the act of writing and the act itself. But even more than that, I believe it is mentioned as we go along here, but it becomes very much more fully developed in later writers. And I'm sorry for sort of becoming explicit, but it's very important given that we are actually talking about legal cases. Any method of suicide which inevitably involves some sort of time elapsing between the act and the effect is considered to fall under this category. So pulling a trigger to one's head would obviously be immediately, but taking pills, death by gas, drowning oneself, all of these various methods which involve some sort of time elapsing, we make the assumption that during that time, the person has in fact regretted, right? I mean, just again, I apologize for the explicitness, but the way in which when, even a person attempting to drown oneself, that struggle at the end, the body rebelling against it, all of these are considered to be a person retracting them, and the category of ma'abed atzmo l'adat is no longer applied in that situation. Let's carry on as he adds another one. The absence of stated intent, despite actions implying otherwise. Elahu hadin, this is also the case, nami b'ma'ase gamur, even with a completely clear action, such as we see him hung Bilan on a tree, al oto ofen, in such a way, shenireh bevadai, which seems absolutely clear, shehu ba'atzmo tala et atzmo, that he hung himself, v'iraken, shenimtza talui b'cheder, v'acheder sagur, he's found in a locked room, mibifnim, from the inside, ba'ofen shenireh shehu sagur ba'atzmo, it seems that he locked it himself, o nafur al hasayach, or having fallen on a sword, harizeh chazaka she'ibed atzmo b'yado, even though it seems clearly he did kill himself, but we don't have this stated intent, be it the verbal, be it the written. Look at this line. Mikol makom shelob midat haya. We say that this was done unwittingly. De talinan ruach ra'a biyatato. We assume that an evil spirit overcame him. Ruach ra is a phrase which has a long history in rabbinic thought, dibuks, malicious spirits. I find it hard to, albeit this is 100 years before Freud, I find it hard to not see this as some sort of sensitivity to what we would only call today mental illness, which is the understanding that a person who finds himself in such a situation, such a terrible situation, is not bedat, cannot be considered to be fully in control. They are in such a terrible situation. We can't say that is an act committed clearly, consciously, with a clear mind. And so, even though everything seems to prove that this is a case of willing suicide, in the absence of a absolutely clearly stated intent, we say ruach ra'a. Adina?
And you referred to the time delay.
Yeah.
So the current, like, statistical research would very much support that, in the sense that, as you said, like, guns are a very bad thing, but most people, there's, like, success rates of various suicide methods, and a lot of people who try, like, a lot of methods do seek help in the interim, like, after
right.
taking the action. So it would suggest that the research supports what the rabbis that you're...
Thank you. Thank you. I can't pretend to be an expert whatsoever in the current statistics. I appreciate that. One book which, if you're interested in reading more generally, Alvarez's The Savage God, a study of suicide. The first chapter is sort of a memoir and remembering the death of his friend, the poet Sylvia Plath. And from there he goes on to a study of suicide. Very clearly in his description, Sylvia Plath, a number of attempted suicides over the years, the final one which is successful, it's heartbreaking. She takes up milk and bread to her sleeping children. She then locks herself in the kitchen and she turns on the gas, and she leaves a note saying, please, she knows the au pair is coming at 9 o'clock, this is at like 7:30, and she leaves a note saying, please call Dr. So-and-so. Right, and what's taken as sort of like an iconic 20th century case of suicide in the Chatam Sofer's reading could never actually be defined as a case of ma'abed atzmo ledat and applying the sanctions. Thank you very much, Dina, for that. Moving on, you'll recall that the topic divided into two, really. It was both the definition of suicide, which we've been focusing on until now, but it was also the question of what would one do after the case of a suicide, in terms of how do we mourn for such a person. And you'll remember that we had the distinction between kavod l'chayim and kavod l'meitin, honour to the living and honour to the dead, that we apply that which is an honour to the living, we withhold that which is an honour to the dead. You'll remember the machloket, the dispute between Rambam and Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides. Maimonides, and following him the Shulchan Aruch, believe that that also applies to Shiva and Shloshim, that we don't spend 7 days mourning for a suicide. The Chatam Sofer says that the way he reads it, it really seems like the Ramban is correct. If you remember right at the beginning, that seeming dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael, what do we say about a suicide? Rabbi Yishmael curses the person. Rabbi Akiva says, Haniach b'stamo, just leave him be. The Chatam Sofer says, I don't understand how everybody has missed this. We all know that Rabbi Akiva is authoritative and the halacha follows Rabbi Akiva, and this is just a lovely play for those of you who read halachic works regularly to see this. After he goes on this long piece to really prove that the halacha is indeed like the Ramban, he then says, this point here, vehine, towards the end of the right at the end of the second line in this category, vehine la halacha, but when it comes to halachic practice, ulama aser, and practically, mi yarim rosh neged horat v'haskama tarav beit Yosef b'shulchan aruch, who on earth can go against the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch is authoritative, no matter how good one's workings out are, one can never dispute with the Shulchan Aruch, who decides that the halacha is in fact like Maimonides, that we don't observe Shiva and Shloshim, uv shagam, and in furthermore, we have this principle, we're going to get into it now, halacha kedivrei hamekel ba'avelut, that in the categories in talks about mourning, halach, the law follows the lenient opinion, which means that we do less, so we don't do more. Who on earth can argue with the Shulchan Aruch? Nobody can, but then, in the very next paragraph, that's exactly what he goes on to do. Omnam, nevertheless, mikol makom, in any case, Omer Ani, I say, Hecha de'ika kavod mishpachat nichbedet, in a case where family honor is at stake, where not sitting Shiva, being known as a family which one of their members has committed suicide, in such a case, then everything changes. He says, if it would be the case that if the family were to sit Shiva, this would, and they don't want to, it's obviously a significant social stigma, certainly according to all these rabbinic writings, to be known as a family which have lost somebody or to not be able to say Kaddish. In such a case, I would certainly say that they sit Shiva, that Kaddish is said. The final line here, V'nehi le'inyan avel halach kedivrei hamekel, and even though when it comes to general laws of mourning, we say that the law follows the lenient opinion, we do less, in other words, like Maimonides. Aval le'inyan pegam mishpacha, when it comes to the honor of a family, ein halacha kemekel b'chvod b'nei Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov, we would certainly never say to be lenient when it comes to the honor of the Jewish people. In any case where the family would feel that they have suffered some loss by the fact that they don't sit Shiva or they don't say Kaddish, then absolutely we do tell them to sit Shiva, to say Kaddish, even if it turns out that this is clearly a case of ma'abedat ma'abedat, which, as we have seen, the halach chatam sofer has made almost impossible to actually apply in any case. I'll take the question in a moment. Let me just finish up now with the suicide post-chatam sofer with one single response, and look how much has changed. The definition of suicide stated intent was an obligation beforehand. In its absence, writes the chatam sofer, no scenario, however compelling, is considered suicide. That was the first point. The second one was, we need to see it carried through. That went through the Gemara, through the Maimonides, through the Shulchan Aruch. The Chatam Sofer says we actually need to see it to be carried through and not just have its end. Secondly, without any time delay whatsoever, as I mentioned, later authorities will rule that all methods which involve a time delay between action and result are not considered suicide, as the person would have regretted at the last minute. In a case where there is any doubt whatsoever, we say Ruach Ra, an evil spirit, is assumed to have been operative. When it comes to mourning for a suicide, the Chatam Sofer argues that the opinion of the Ramban of Nachmanides that a suicide is mourned for is more compelling, but sees that the opinion of the authoritative Shulchan Aruch cannot be argued with. Nevertheless, he introduces the concept of family honour, for which one must act like the Ramban and allow the family to mourn. Yeah. It would do if it's involved with Pagam Mishpacha. Yeah. On that narrow track of Kavod Mishpacha, the honour of the family, it wouldn't. However, this is only on the assumption that we have defined this as a case of Ma'bed Atzmo B'dat, the person wittingly taking their life. The Chatam Sofer, and following him everybody else, makes it almost completely impossible to ever have such a situation. So in any situation which is generally in English referred to as suicide, halachically it is not defined as ma'abed, that's ma'abedat, and therefore ripping of clothes and eulogies would absolutely be applied. Tell you what, I've got 2 minutes to finish and then we'll take all the questions. I opened with this very harsh source from Gesher HaChaim, which said that suicide is like murder. Gesher HaChaim is a wonderful work written by Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tikhochinsky in the 1940s. Even though he started off with such a strong piece, he nevertheless, in the continuation of the chapter, I've separated the sources, but they follow one another. Source number 9 writes as follows, this is my translation. In the vast majority of cases that appear to be ma'abed, that's more ladat, wittingly destroying oneself, we do not judge it thus. For in every case where we can conceivably claim that it was something else that killed him, even if exceedingly unlikely, or if it can be claimed that he was under extreme duress, or his mind was not truly with him, or if it is possible that in the final moments of his struggle with death he regretted, we judge leniently that this is not a case of suicide. And in response, Besamim Rosh, sorry, that shouldn't read Bashamayim, that's supposed to be Besamim Rosh, we are given a leniency that goes too far. He now quotes something else post Chatam Sofer. The Besamim Rosh wrote that anyone who kills himself on account of great woes and strains is not to be considered ma'abed atzmo ladat, right? Just, you know, anyone who just got too much, that's not going to be considered suicide. Says Gesher HaChaim, that surely goes too far. For if one were to say thus, the category would cease to exist, for all suicides on account of such pain. Nevertheless, if Charlotte Saref da talk a snif lahakel, we can combine his opinion whenever there is any other small reason to think that this may be a case, not be a case of ma'abed at smoladat. So what a journey has gone from viewing suicide in such harsh, terrible terms and applying all of these sanctions to a case where we effectively no longer have the category. As far as I know, there is no Jewish cemetery which still today has a separate area for suicide. I want to make, right at the end in the short amount of time, what I think is quite a nuanced but an important point. It's not that the Jewish view of suicide has changed. It's not that it is now viewed in any way in a more positive or less more forgiving light. This has not moved us to a position which says it's all about autonomy and the individual. The idea of suicide itself, the idea of the value of the preservation of life, is still held to as strongly as it ever was. It's the same Gesher HaChaim who started off that first source. But the understanding that a person who finds himself in such a situation, the terrible situation they must find themselves in, has led the Chatam Sofer and everybody after him to make the practical application of it almost impossible. And I think, despite that fact that we're talking about law, which is often a difficult medium for making sensitive personal points, we've actually arrived at a fascinating situation. The idea itself is still one which is seen as negatively as it ever was. In terms of applying it to any individual, in such a case, the sensitivity to a person's situation completely overrides it. I'll just finish with one final source, not about suicide, but which I think serves as a wonderful insight into the way in which halakha should function. Written by the Magid Mishnah, one of the great medieval commentators on Maimonides. I won't read the whole source, but he speaks about how the Torah often gives very general guidelines. Kedoshim tihyu, you shall be holy. Asita hayashar v'hatov, do that which is just and that which is right. The Torah speaks in generalities, says the Magid Mishnah, because it wouldn't be fitting to command specifics, because the Torah and mitzvot are eternal, but the nature of man and the practice of man and human societies changes from one era to another era. And so by speaking in generalities, that gives the necessary flex, the necessary space for Jewish leaders, rabbis, thinkers at every stage in time to allow the Torah to be eternal despite the fact that human society is ever-changing. This is just one case study of it. I hope that it's shown that a value and idea is carried through, but nevertheless, far heightened sensitivity to the plight of an individual in such a situation is maintained. Thank you very much. I know time is up. I'm very happy to take questions. One, two, let's do questions first, and then I'll try and take them, yeah. It's a very, very strange idea, halacha kedivrei hamekel ba'avelut. What it seems to mean is that we take the side which instructs us to do less. The Ramban tells us to do more. The Ramban tells us to sit shiva. Right? That's to do more. So with that, he doesn't take that. Yeah.
I was reading that in the late 18th century there was a copycat suicide scare.
Thank you.
After the publication of
The
Sirs of Young Werther. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if the Samuel Swarthmore, he's talking about that when he says accounts of great woe.
So this is something I've been thinking about a lot, trying to link the Hatem Sofer to what was going on in Europe at the time with the concept of suicide. I spoke to Professor Adam Furziger about this at Bar-Ilan a few weeks ago. Being a very full-on scholar, he was hesitant to say anything definite. Goethe published The Sorrows of Young Werther in 1770. That produced the first instance of copycat suicides of young men across Europe taking their lives into such romantic woe. 35 years later, the Hatem Sofer writes this piece which completely changes the Jewish take on it. Is there a connection? I definitely can't prove it, but it's certainly very fascinating, and it certainly corresponds at least to that idea of ruach hara, of an evil spirit, of a beginning to be aware of the conditions. I will just point out that horrendous piece that we started with, of the description in London of a person being hung after trying to take their lives, is 55, not that that would have occurred in Jewish law, but even so, it's 55 years after the Hatem Sofer has completely eliminated the category from halakhic practice. Yeah? The biblical proof text is Achdimchem v'nafshotechem edrosh, a verse in Parshat Noach, Bereshit chapter 9. I will hold you accountable for the blood that you shed, and the reading of it is even your own blood that you shed. It's not.
So it's not explicit.
That's correct, yeah. Well, one really needs to be a serious historian, which I am not, to know the gap between when it becomes written on paper in the response literature and when it actually manifests itself. I did spend some time at Bushey Cemetery last year, and I know that in the very early 20th century they no longer had this section, but which is nevertheless 100 years after the Hatem Sofer. There may well indeed be a time lag. These days, nothing really is added post this. I will just say an interesting situation that in Emek HaYarden, in the Jordan Valley in Israel in the 1990s, there was a spate of suicides throughout the kibbutzim, young religious men taking their lives, and there was discussion at the time about revoking and going back to a pre-Hatem Sofer in order to give more sort of punch to the sanctions to prevent it. I don't think they actually did, but the conversation was there. Yeah.
I'm talking
98. 98, I would be astonished to see that.
I was there.
I'm sorry.
The last quote was from 1940, you said.
Yeah.
You know that there was an epidemy suicide just before the war, during the war, after the war in Europe. Right. So probably the harsh way he described suicide at one side and the lenient way he described the result of suicide fits into this.
Interesting. By the time you get to the 1940s, the Hatem Sofer has already become completely authoritative.
Yeah, but it's not the Hatem Sofer, it's the context here.
Right, right. Thank you. Precisely. Every single, notwithstanding the question that was asked a minute ago, which I don't know anything about at all, every single case that I have ever heard of, that I've ever spoken to rabbinic colleagues about, any case of what is called in suicide English is never called halakhically ma'abed, that's ma'abedat.
In a sense, the fact that the family and the person are treated in a normal way is good, but
I suppose if one were to be nuanced and want to, one would say, well, they're actually two distinct concepts. Although I've called them ma'abed, that's ma'abedat, suicide throughout this lecture, they are not actually the same idea.
Halakhically, it's not a suicide, but that doesn't mean the family can't be.
I think so. I think that would probably be it.